So, this morning we did a little bit of looking at emotions, and I was talking about how the basic cause of dukkha is that our mind has learned to operate in terms of a subject. In here, usually, confronting various objects which are seen as out there in the world. And that creates tension, and that tension then, if we don't manage to sit with it, produces craving and aversion. There's either something out there that we want, or there's something out there that we don't want. And so the craving or the aversion arise in some form or another. So we did that practice where we were unhooking, we were finding an emotion and unhooking from the object. What it was about, unhooking from the subject, the me that's the one who has the emotion, and then trying to get underneath even the concepts about the emotion itself. Yes, that this is anger, this is grief, this is whatever it is. And then in a way that leaves you just with the experience. And that may be enough, but you may also find it helpful to look into the nature, just to check out that actually there's nothing substantial there. There's nothing. What can you get hold of? What is there? There's flow, there's energy. And usually the best way to do that is quite lightly. Yeah. It's almost like you kind of put a little question mark against your experience. Kind of like, what is this really? So with quite a light touch. So I had one or two questions about how things could unfold after an initial seeing into no self. And there are different ways, there are different kinds of seeing, there are different depths of clarity of seeing. So there isn't a kind of one size fits all answer to any of this. But one way in which things can go is, well, you can keep on seeing into no self. Usually that one seeing doesn't actually eradicate it. Although often it sort of becomes more kind of nebulous. There's this sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya, called the Kaimukha Sutta, which I wrote about in an article in Shabda a while ago, which is on my website. And I know other people who are interested in this area have sort of picked up on it. There's a bhikkhu called Kaimukha who is very ill, and the local elders of the Sangha, they send somebody to him to inquire whether he's bearing up, whether he has support, whether his pains are increasing or decreasing. And after various to-ings and fro-ings of the messenger, Kaimukha decides that he'll go and talk to the elders himself. And what the elders are asking him about is, they're saying, well, it seems that you've seen that the five skandhas aren't self, that the body isn't self, and the feelings aren't self, and so on. So you're an arahant, aren't you? So in that sense, you've done what had to be done, and you're ready to die if your illness goes that way. But Kemika says, well, no, I'm not. And what he says is that although he's quite clear that none of the five skandhas are self, still there is an I sense. In fact, at one point he calls it an I obsession that's still there. And he gives a couple of examples or illustrations. And one is, it's a bit like this, he says, it's like the scent of a flower. So you can't say, you know, that the scent is really coming from this petal or that part, and yet somehow you might be able to analyse it scientifically or something, but in general experience, it's as if the scent is just coming somehow generally from the flower. So even though he's kind of done that work of really looking into experience, and even though he's clear that the self isn't in any of the places which it has to be in, still there's this kind of sense of self living a kind of ghostly half-life hanging around. Yeah? And the other illustration he gives is of it's like you've got some dirty bit of clothing and it goes to the cleaners. So in ancient India, it comes back smelling of cow dung or something. It's clean, but it's, you know, it has this particular aroma. So it gets put into a sort of scented basket, and after a while it loses that scent. So the idea is, yes, you know, the sense of self has kind of been purified, and yet still there's this sense of it hanging around. And with the second illustration, it may be more that what you can smell now is the purification process. It was cleaned with this wonderful clean cow dung, and you can smell that, which maybe suggests that, okay, you saw there's no self, but you haven't just forgotten yourself. There's still this sense of me who knows there's no self. Yeah. There's still, if you like, there's still something in you that's revolving around the whole question and the whole issue, rather than simply going into the flow of life and there not being any self-reference at all. And well, it's always one of the traps, the pitfalls on the path is that, and it seems this can happen again and again, is that you have some kind of further seeing, some further unfolding, and then you grasp onto that. Yeah. There's always the possibility that it was a genuine experience, but then as you fall out of it to some extent, that ghostly sense of self kind of sneaks up and kind of goes, I saw that. I'm there. Yeah. So we turn a genuine insight back into a sort of ego credential to some degree. So yeah, it's kind of interesting, the Kemika Sutta, that if Kemika is to be believed, and he found his way into the Sanyutta Nikaya, so a lot of people obviously believed him. That sense of self can be there without any very kind of clear definition. You know, in quite a sort of difficult way to pin down through quite a lot of the path. And to some extent, it gets kind of reinforced by a sense of the path and further steps for me to go. Because there isn't just a complete self-forgetting, there's still some kind of referring back to the one who has more to do on the path. Which isn't to say that we just, well, we can't, when there is still more to do, it's not like we can pretend there isn't and just stop. But we need to be aware of that sort of kind of undertow, that negative undertow of that way of looking at things. Yeah, because where we're heading, I think we had a reading the other evening from Lama Govinda that Ambarantar did, which says something, was it threefold is the rhythm of life, taking, giving, self-forgetting. Yeah, so it's almost like you start by, you know, concern with self and, you know, can I get what I need and am I all right here? And then you practice and you start to open your heart and you take other people into consideration and that develops and develops. And so you go from taking to much more giving and that develops further. But then the next stage is self-forgetting. There's really, there's just a flow of what we'd call skillful action, but with no reference back to me and how I'm doing or how well I'm doing or any of that. One of the marks of an irreversible bodhisattva is that it never occurs to them to wonder whether they're irreversible or not. So it's, yeah. Okay, so that was a long sort of, that was a point in itself, and that started from talking about ways in which the path can develop. So I was, that was around how issues with the path post insight, but then in terms of how you work, yeah. You can work, as I say, with still exploring this sense of self, this kind of spectral self that's this me that's still there, even though you can't quite pin it down. You can work with the craving and aversion. So I suppose in the traditional model of the fetters, that's kind of what happens. You look into non-self, and then you explore the fourth and fifth fetters, which are about craving and aversion. And then at some point, certainly Mahayana Buddhism would say, you need to explore the everything that's out there. You need to explore the nature of that and the status of that. You need to take on, because even with an insight into non-self, you may still have a sense of me here and the world out there, and you're taking all that as real. And it seems that you can gain enlightenment without really exploring that very far. If in Pali Buddhism, the external world, it treats it pretty much, what in Western philosophy is called direct realism. It just kind of takes it on its own terms. You know, there's a tree and there's a house and that's Karunamekha and there we are. But as Buddhism developed, there was a whole move into looking at the empty nature of everything that we experience out there, in inverted commas. And that's helpful to do because Well, because when we take something as real, it affects us deeply. And particularly if we're on the Bodhisattva path, which is the only path to be on. It's the only game in town, as far as I'm concerned. Then that involves opening our heart to the world and to suffering. And if we take all that as really real and really serious, that's going to be a factor in us being overwhelmed. Earlier in the year, I gave a series of talks at the Cambridge Centre on aspects of going for refuge, and in the third one, I spent quite a lot of time talking about overwhelm. I think I gave a list of about a dozen ways of working with overwhelm. But actually, the best and deepest would be if we could see the empty, illusory nature of what we take as the outside world. Because then it's like on the relative level, you're working to do everything you can to help, whilst on another level, knowing that it's like a dream, it's like an illusion, it's like a mirage, it's like an echo, it's like all those traditional similes. Yeah. That gives you the room to manoeuvre, that gives you the freedom to address all that from a stance where, yeah, that's what allows the Bodhisattva's activity to be their leela, their play. So yeah, we could look into the nature of all this. And then finally, we really need to look into that sense, whatever there is still at this point, because everything is becoming more fluid. Yeah, we're sort of breaking up that sense of solid things and things being like this and people like that and I'm like this, and we're really starting to get much more into that sort of flow of life, of that fluidity, which that whole sort of Anicca aspect of things. So everything's becoming more of a flow, more of a dance, and but still it can feel like it's a flow and a dance between kind of like two poles, and there's still some kind of separation between the two. So we need to somehow come to the point where there is that complete seeing through of that subject-object crevasse. And we can do that partly through a real deep relaxation and letting go. But also by questioning, again, sort of taking away the questioning the concepts that we have about the way in which we're seeing things in terms of completely separate me here and everything else out there. You can sometimes, some people can do it just by really kind of looking at experience in that just sort of direct experience way and trying to get underneath the concepts. Okay, so it's like, do I end, beyond my knees? Actually, if we've already seen that we're not the body, then how can I end here and everything else start there? Anyway, it's possible just through burrowing under those concepts to for it to come, for that that whole structure to fall away. For a lot of people, sound seems to be a really good way into that. You have to, again, get underneath the sense of me in here listening to the sound over there. And we're just really in a relaxed way, just really taking the labels off, that's a blackbird, that's a tractor, and all the stories, do we have to have a tractor going by when I'm trying to meditate? We take all that apart, we take off the labels, but then even that sense of me in here and it out there, we can get underneath that as well. And then see what happens. There's lots of areas we can just go and play in, and we don't have to put pressure on ourselves that I still haven't understood this or that or the other. Usually in response to all this kind of language, part of us kind of wants to know, and we can really sort of stay with that feeling and sort of hold it in our heart. That bit that that longs to really understand, that longs to be really one with life, that longs to just lose the burden of carrying around me sort of morning, noon and night. Although we do actually put it down. Actually, we put down that sense of me every day, otherwise we'd never fall asleep. Yeah? It's when we don't fall asleep, that's because me is continuing. But with falling asleep, we're very relaxed, but then the awareness completely goes. But we do know how to put down that way of functioning, that meing, that selfing. We all do it, so it's not something we've never come across at all. So on one level, there's that. There's that longing, that longing to know. And that very quickly jumps into, what can I do? I must do this, I must do that, but it all seems too much and I can't do it. So just stay with that longing, that bit that longs to be fully connected with life, fully in life, just alive, not separate. That bit that really wants to understand, that bit that really wants to be intimate with everything, which connects to sort of love. And then we just take an area and we just start to look. We start to go into it. We start to practice, We start to, however we do it, we reflect, we explore. And as I say, we keep it a little bit kind of light and playful and curious. And as the days, months, and years go by, it unfolds. We could spend, I'll stop saying we could spend lots of time on this. It's getting tedious. If one's broken the first fetter, does that mean that one does not experience the self again? Or does it mean that one does experience the self in difficult situations, but can immediately see through it, understand that it's an illusion created in the moment by the mind? Okay, so I've kind of answered that, talking about the Kamika Sutta. It seems like, unless you have a very profound experience, that sense of me is still going to be hanging around. As for breaking the first fetter, I'm still not sure that in Triratna we have a kind of agreed view about the first three fetters and stream entry. Because different traditions talk about it in different ways. Bodhiketu wrote an article in the Western Buddhist Review a while ago, sort of looking at some of those passages in the Pali Canon, which say, which sort of set the bar at different heights. One view is that a stream entrant is going to be perfect in morality, in the sense that if there's any unskillfulness, they'll, as soon as they become aware of it, they'll let it go. And there are lesser versions down from that. Yeah, I'd really like, over the years, listening to Bhante talk about stream entry, there have been times where some of the time it sounded like, oh, it's not very far away, it's just here. And other times it sounded like, oh, it's really lofty and it's way over there. And doubtless that was partly me and the different states I was in, when I was listening to him. I'd quite like someone to go, do a good search through all those millions of words and sort of bring together some of the things that Bhante said about it. And then us to have some kind of common understanding of what we mean, because otherwise I can say, breaking the first fetter means this. But I'm, maybe it's my lack of understanding, but yes, I don't have a clear sense of how Bhante's defined it. So, and this is work in progress, and it's one of the reasons why I'm a bit wary of people claiming to be somewhere on the path, because we may not be meaning the same thing, and that's a recipe for difficulty. So, I mean, talking about experiences, that's very helpful in the right circumstances. But
sorry, Ms. Andrew, could you repeat that last sentence?
Talking about experiences is very helpful under the right circumstances. Yeah. But yes, because we don't have to my way of thinking, we don't have we haven't rectified terms. It's not really clear what we might be meaning. If somebody says to me, I'm a stream entrant, I actually have to go back and ask them what their experience is. That means they think that, so I'd rather just talk about the experiences. Yeah. Which isn't said, it can be helpful to have a sense of, this kind of thing has happened to me, and so that probably means that I should explore this next. That's having some sense of how things can unfold is helpful, but I'm not sure we've quite developed the mechanisms fully for doing it. I think it's still work in progress. It's all interesting area. Could you say something about the relationship between glimpses of no self and a sustained realization of no self? Also, how one goes about deepening and integrating that realization. That's kind of the area I've been talking, I guess. And again, language is just rather, we have to do our best with it. But a lot of these terms cover a big range of sort of actual experience of us as human beings. A seeing of no self could be a lot, could be on a very big spectrum. From something which maybe is still actually subtly conceptual, to something which is genuine but fades quite quickly to something which stays with us and which we can kind of get back to, you know, just with mindfulness and fresh looking, to some experience where that sense of self is just really deeply cut through. Deepening and integrating that realization. I've talked about areas that you can look into a little bit. So much in this. Relaxation becomes more and more important as you go on. It really supports, as well as continuing to look, the relaxation kind of goes along with and supports the process that the seeing has catalyzed. And quite a lot of the work sort of posts some degree of real insight is just feeling into the body more and more and more and relaxing more deeply. And it's like there are, you know, there are deeply kind of held blockages, emotional kind of, I want to say scrunched up bits. You get the picture anyway. And those need to be brought into awareness and relaxed and relaxed. So there's a whole work to do there. And then there is just integrating that realization into our whole Dharma life, our whole overall way of practice. It's one very important aspect of it. And particularly for me, integrating it into into the moving in the direction of the Bodhisattva ideal, put it like that. There's a question about sadhana. So this person has been attempting to do their sadhana since they were ordained a little while ago. And I seem to fall into doing the practice quite literally. And don't connect well with it. But then fall into the opposite of being too loose and vague. I want to do my sadhana more faithfully and regularly. But I'm surprised how easily it slips. I mean, to some extent, this is a question between you and your private preceptor. I I think one sort of general point is that your faith, what is your faithfulness to fundamentally? Because you can faithfully do your sadhana every day, but that may not actually, in some cases it's just what's needed, but sometimes it may not be what's really the most effective way for you to practice. So your fundamental fidelity is to your going for refuge to the three jewels. Yeah. Your commitment to use this language, move along the path to enlightenment, in concert with, in harmony with other members of the order. But sometimes we can get caught up in a more sort of narrow sense of fidelity, which actually doesn't fit in with our fundamental sense of fidelity and what we're trying to do. Yeah. So with sadhana, say, to bring it up a level, your fundamental loyalty is to the yidam, and the yidam is an expression of particular qualities. So if you're practicing green tara, say, then your fundamental fidelity is to keep contacting and unfolding and deepening love, compassion, and wisdom. Yeah. So if you're doing that, then you're being faithful, in my book, to green tara. So you might be doing a sadhana every day, but it's not quite what you need. In fact, it seems to get in the way of a more natural way of practice. And it would be a slower way of unfolding love, compassion, and wisdom. So it wouldn't make sense to do that. All the practices are tools to help us unfold. So we don't want to be literal-minded around this. We don't want to be doing it for the sake of it, even though part of the motivation is a genuine loyalty and faithfulness. That loyalty and faithfulness doesn't want to be too narrow or too literal. Yeah? The loyalty and faithfulness are great. They're beautiful. But so there needs to be sort of space around the ways in which we practice. At the same time, for a lot of people, particularly in their early years of practice, doing something every day, as I say, maybe just what they need, because you sort of pattern your mind in a particular way. To start with, it feels like you're just creating this sense of tara, and as soon as you stop, it disappears. But through doing that, at a certain point, it starts to feel as if something is coming through that sort of sense of tara that you feel you've created, and the whole thing starts to go deeper. Also, if you don't do the practice, it's worth looking, really understanding the practice and the different aspects of the practice, because all of them are pointing at something to do. They're all pointing at aspects of how you can unfold further, and they're all demonstrations of how things really are. Everything about sadhana is that. But yes, whether this particular person, how much they should do their sadhana, they need to explore with their private preceptor. Okay, I've talked lots, so let's stop and have 10 minutes break, and then we'll come back and meditate.